there. This is Hannah Branigan back with another explosive episode of Drinking from the Toilet, a podcast about real dogs, real training, and leveling up your skills as a real dog trainer. Whether you do it professionally or not, you probably shouldn't because I can tell you there's not really any money in it. But anyways, this week we are digging into a really big topic that's critical to our jobs, our roles as teachers and trainers of all species, dogs and humans being no exception, and that is the concept of fluency. Fluency is, in many ways, another word for mastery of a skill or behavior, which is what we want for our learners. That's kind of the whole point of what we're doing. When we're trying to teach them new skills, and we want them to learn them to the point of mastery. But there are a lot of factors and moving parts that all have to work together to build that fluent behavior. And that can be a lot to keep track of as a trainer, to keep everything moving forward in the right proportions to get the outcome that we're looking for. And so before we dig into that topic, I wanted to let you guys know that I will be opening up enrollment for my Novice Obedience Mentorship Program in a couple of weeks, because that's exactly what we do there. That's what that program is for. It's to give you an integrated system for balancing all those spinning plates that you have to keep in the air to build a fluent performance, to get in the ring, to be successful. There's a lot of behaviors involved. There's a lot of different components and elements that we have to keep building, keep strong, and maintain, and have them all work together. And it's just a lot to do on your own. And so that's why I put a program together to help you do that. So if you're interested in more information on that program, check out Zero to CD. That's www.zerotocd.com. And that's all spelled out with letters. I don't know if that was a good choice or a bad choice when I got the URL, but that's ZeroTocd.com. So check it out, and I think you might find something interesting there. Now, let's dig into the concept of fluency. So what is fluency? We talk about it a lot. What does it really mean? Well, if you think about the way most of us first hear the word fluency or fluent, and usually we're talking about like the linguistic definition. So if we talk about somebody being fluent in a language, like she's fluent in Japanese, I'm fluent in Pig Latin, then what we're really meaning is that the person is able to say the right words without stumbling. So in a normal conversation, they're able to listen to the words that they're hearing and then respond with the correct words without hesitating. And so it's that ability to do something, to perform a behavior effortlessly and appropriately execute the desired behavior at the right time. And that's what fluency is. Doing something without hesitation, without having to think too hard about it. So in some respects, fluency is a measure of how easy it is for us or for our dogs to perform a behavior, to do something. How many brain cells does it take? The fewer brain cells it takes, the more likely the behavior is to be fluent. So if you think about all of the behaviors that you do on a regular basis, which is probably not something that normal people spend a lot of time thinking about, but if you're like a weird training geek like I am, maybe you think about all of your behaviors on a, you know, maybe it keeps you up at night. I don't know. Not that it does me, but maybe it does you. I don't know. Anyway, so think about all of the different behaviors that you do on a regular basis. Can you think of things that you can do, but only if you're really concentrating? So for me, a good example is like doing my bookkeeping on QuickBooks. So I know I complain about QuickBooks a lot on the podcast. I complain about it in the blog, and I certainly complain about it extensively on social media. I'm not a complaining kind of person, but QuickBooks is definitely a behavior that I can do, but it takes a lot of focus. It's very expensive for me. I have to block off time every other week to make sure that I sit down and do it. I can't have any distractions or the whole thing just falls apart relatively quickly. It's not a fluent behavior. It's not that I'm incapable. It's just that it's very, very effortful for me. And frankly, I'd rather not do it. But you kind of have to, because I also don't want to go to jail. But if you also think about those behaviors you can do without even thinking about it. And we all have a repertoire of those behaviors. Fluent behaviors are less effortful. So if I think about, you know, what are the things that I do that are basically take no conscious effort on my part, one of the first ones that pops into my head is the behavior of opening the refrigerator door. It costs me nothing. If I walk into the kitchen, I'm almost certainly going to open the refrigerator, regardless of why I walked into the kitchen in the first place. In fact, it's such a strong behavior for me, for whatever reason. I don't know why, because nobody goes grocery shopping except for me. But let's say I walk into the kitchen for some totally different reason, unrelated to the refrigerator, like I'm going to go get some scissors, right? I also keep scissors in our kitchen drawer. So I walk into the kitchen to get refrigerators. I have to actively stop myself from opening the refrigerator so that I can go to the correct drawer and retrieve the scissors. And even though I know that if I open the refrigerator door, there's still not going to be anything new in there that I wasn't in there 15 minutes ago the last time I opened the refrigerator door and stared into it, I still have that behavior is so cheap. It's so automatic that if I'm walking into the kitchen, the most natural thing for me to do is open that refrigerator door. Now, our refrigerator is very old. It's really, really heavy. I am constantly thinking about, you know, the next time when we have some money, like that's ever going to happen. But if it should, we're going to replace that refrigerator so I can have one with a door that actually opens easily. But ours is totally the sort where you have to grab a hold of the handle with both hands, lean back, and yank it open because it's so heavy. It's probably not very energy efficient, but I don't really want to think about that. But that's a physically effortful behavior, and yet it's the very first thing that I do every time I walk into the kitchen. And I often find myself standing in the kitchen in front of the open refrigerator, and I don't even remember opening it. I don't remember why I opened it. I'm looking in there, and yes, sure enough, there's nothing in there that wasn't in there before. Nothing has magically appeared. So go figure. What's the functional reinforcement there? Well, it's just a really easy behavior. It doesn't take a lot of reinforcement. Occasionally, I do open it and there is something interesting, but, you know, not before noon. And anyways, so that's a very cheap behavior for me. It doesn't take a lot of reinforcement. It doesn't take a lot of mental energy. I could probably perform that behavior even if there was a live band performing in my kitchen. Kitchen's not very big. It's maybe 9 feet across. So if there was a live band, that would be a pretty heavy distraction, tight space. I could still get the refrigerator door open. I guarantee it. I could probably also pour a glass of wine. But anyways, moving on. That's a good description of, for me anyways, of a very fluent behavior. It's a strong behavior. It takes very little effort. I can do it without thinking about it. One of the things that I love about thinking about behaviors in terms of fluency is that it really helps me kind of settle into a growth mindset. So, you know, that growth mindset, I'm a big fan of Carol Dweck's work. She talks about growth mindset versus fixed mindset. Growth mindset is definitely where we want to be. If you haven't checked out her books, I recommend that you do. But what I love about conversations that I have with students or other trainers around the concept of fluency is that while it's still not easy, it puts a lot of that locus of control in our power, right? Because fluency is a quality of a behavior. It's not a characteristic of an individual. And so a characteristic of an individual implies something we can't really change. A quality of a behavior, though, I can change behavior. Again, favorite quote from Karen Pryor, all behavior is modifiable, right? So if the behavior is not strong enough, I can create a training plan to strengthen it. So we can own a lot more of our behavior and of our dog's behavior, and we have the ability to make a lot more change than a lot of the times we think. The dug-in doesn't mean that it's easy, but we do have that power. And this is, you know, one of those places, again, where it would be easy to say that, like bookkeeping, QuickBooks, obviously, I just finished a bookkeeping cycle, right? So it's fresh on my mind. But it would be very easy to say that bookkeeping is hard for me because I'm a girl and girls are bad at math. Everybody knows that. I should stick to what I'm good at and go get in the kitchen and make my husband some pie. Okay, I couldn't say that with a straight face. But if I wanted to, and I don't, but if I wanted to, I could put together a training plan and deliberately and systematically improve my bookkeeping skills, strengthen my fluency, and make QuickBooks easier for me. Of course, I have no intention of doing so for so very many reasons. And instead, my solution was to hire a bookkeeper and just chuck all of my receipts into a bag and then mail them to her every other month. And may God have mercy on her soul. But I don't have to do that. I could improve my skill set because I don't actually need anybody to do that for me. Fish, bicycle, if you know what I'm saying. Anyways, back to dog training. Okay, so we circle around the topics of fluency and stimulus control, and I think there's a lot of confusion, and it's something that I still kind of struggle to tease out a little bit. And on the one hand, it doesn't really matter because good training is still going to be good training, but also having clear language to talk about the problems that we're having and talk about our protocols and our procedures and the stuff that we're doing, well, that's really helpful for moving the whole process forward for everybody. So the concepts of fluency and stimulus control have some overlap to a degree. It's really hard to talk about one without the other. But usually when we're using these words, we're talking about different things. We're talking about different slices of that ABC behavior environment unit. So generally, we can divide what we're talking about into two categories, roughly aligning with stimulus control and fluency as we use them in dog training conversations. So several months ago, I was reading a parenting book, and I ran across some phrasing that I just totally love. And so I'm going to basically completely steal it right now. And it's this idea that we have two tasks in getting an outcome. There's the concept of knowing what to do, and then there's doing what you know. And from a brain neurological perspective, these are two completely different processes. Knowing what to do is a pattern recognition task. It's taking in the stimuli that you're exposed to, identifying, oh, it's cold here, or the light turned green, and recognizing it and identifying what behavior goes with that particular pattern of sensory stimuli experiences that you have. And that's more or less what stimulus control is. On the other hand, there's doing what you know. And that's pretty much what fluency is, right? That's taking action. That's making the thing happen. And I don't know about you, but I can think of a lot of different situations where I know perfectly well what to do. And then there's this vast canyon gap between knowing what to do and actually doing that thing. Again, it comes up so many different places. There's all kinds of places. I know that if I want to be healthier, I have to make certain choices. But actually doing it, totally different task. So there are two different things that our brain has to do. And of course, each one is made up of a lot of different little subtasks, and we could go make ourselves crazy splitting those down even further. But I think from a conversation standpoint, splitting up that pattern recognition, stimulus control component from the fluency, taking action, doing what you know component, making it happen, that's helpful because it does influence how we address our training plans. So, a fluent behavior is a behavior that is performed without hesitation. It's both accurate and precise. And this gets confusing because we tend to, in the dog training world, say precision when what we really mean is accurate by definition. So for our purposes, let's assume that a fluent behavior is both accurate and precise. I feel like I have to explain a little bit, but if you don't come from the science world, this may seem like a meaningless hair splitting thing that I'm getting hung up on for no reason. But in general, or by definition, actually, it's not in general, specifically, precise means that the action is repeatable with the same result. So if you're shooting an arrow at a target, which is the most common visualization I see of these two definitions in textbooks, a precise behavior is where every time you shoot the arrow, it lands basically in the same hole. So you're splitting the arrows with each subsequent arrow. It has nothing to do with how close to the center of the target you're getting. Whereas accurate is close to a standard of measure. So accurate would be getting an arrow in the center of the bullseye. Now, you may only get 1 out of 10 arrows in the center of the bullseye. So ideally, we want both precise and accurate, which is that all of our arrows hit in the center of the bullseye. So in real life, how this plays out is that if you talk to a person, a human, just for example, because it's harder to talk to other species, but humans we can usually talk to. So if you talk to a human who's very fluent at some behavior, they often aren't even fully aware of what it is that they're doing in that behavior. And in fact, it can be really hard to get them to describe what it is that they're doing, particularly how you can do it yourself too, which is one of the things that can make it really frustrating to learn from someone who is just a really elite master of a skill when you're just in the very beginning stages. And I've had this experience most recently in like agility seminars where I'll go and I'll work with a really high level competitor who is a phenomenal dog handler, and I'm trying to just get started on a very basic level. And there's this huge gap in them being able to articulate what it is that they're doing in a such a way that I can then repeat it with zero experience. And that can be frustrating really on both sides. I've also had that experience, with things again in real life and also of course in my professional life, stuff that I'm really good at, stuff that I can do without thinking about, how can I describe to somebody else what it is that I'm doing? And that's a big cognitive task. Because it is the nature of the fluent behavior is that we've already put aside all of those brain cells we used in those early stages to make the process as efficient as possible, which is great. That's how it's supposed to work. That's what we want fluent behaviors to be like. You should be able to do them without thinking about it. But that does mean that for those learners who don't have the top to the puzzle box, right? They can't see the big picture. We have to put some work into teaching it. And that's the case a lot of the times with our dogs, and of course also with our human learners, but we're mostly talking about dogs here. So the characteristics of a fluent behavior, and more importantly, how we can get them, is something we really want to put a lot of thought into, something I constantly put a lot of thought into. I seem to do little else half the time. So fluent behaviors are better. They are better behaviors from a qualitative standpoint than other behaviors. Quantitatively, this often, again, comes down to that precision, accuracy variable. And what I'm looking for to measure the fluency of a behavior, I'm looking for kind of two things. First, I'm looking for clean loops. So if you refer back to our episode on loopy training, when we talk about the movement cycle, I frequently, with my students, define a fluent behavior as one where as soon as the dog swallows the treat, he immediately performs the exact same behavior again. So if we're getting a pattern where the dog eats the treat and sits and eats the treat and sits and nothing else happens between swallowing the treat and initiating the next behavior, then we're usually in pretty good shape in terms of fluency. I'm also looking for a consistent performance. Even if it's a very small slice of the behavior, a fluent behavior should be the same mechanically from one repetition to the next. There shouldn't be a ton of variability. And smaller motor tasks are easier to perform consistently. Think about how easy it is to touch, a small spot with a single finger and hit the same spot every time over and over again versus kicking a soccer ball over some distance, right? Like the more muscles involved, the larger the distance, the bigger the movement, the harder it is to land that ball in exactly the same spot every single time. So it's easier to get smaller movements fluent than bigger ones. We can still get bigger ones. It just takes more time, a little bit more thought. So what we want to do is break any behavior we're teaching into those small tasks, those small muscle movements that the dog can repeat the same way each time, and then build on those. So if you think about a behavior like sit, which again, super geeky, but I think about sit all the time, and I use sit as an example a lot because basically every dog trainer on the planet is teaching a dog to sit in some way. Some people care more about how the dog sits. Some people care significantly less about how the dog sits. I, of course, care excessively about how the dog sits to the point where it's a problem, but it's something I'm working on and we don't need to go into that here. But dogs can sit, and if you spent any time with me virtually or in person, dogs can sit in a lot of different ways. We talk about it on the podcast. We talk about it on the blog. We talk about it in the classes. I have an entire presentation at Clicker Expo about how dogs sit, and I can talk for days about sitting. Again, I don't want to bore you, but it's such a nice behavior because dogs can sit with their front feet still. They can sit with their back feet still. They can have their back feet to the left. They can have their back feet to the right. In Rugby's case, he can have all 4 feet pointing in totally different directions and still get his butt on the ground. So there's lots of different ways for a dog to sit. And this is where that precision and accuracy element comes in. He could sit perfectly straight one time out of 10, and that would be fantastic, right? Like, that would certainly be better than sitting zero times straight out of 10, which is kind of where we started. But that's still not where I need him to be. I need him to sit the same way each time for this behavior to be fluent for my purposes. So it needs to be, you know, within consistent criteria. Oh, hey, there's that criteria word. Not my favorite thing, but there's no real good way to escape it. So I'm looking for that, a way to set up the environment, to set up my training session to get that same sit or piece of a sit over and over again, so that I have this consistent movement pattern that I can reinforce. Now, of course, there's also a burden on me to make sure that I reinforce consistently. But I think from a practical standpoint, more importantly than what you're clicking and treating here is considering the setup. And by setup, I mean how you use the environment. Are you using a target or using a platform or a barrier, any of those things, but also how you're delivering the treat, what the dog's starting position is. Those are probably the two most critical parts, where the dog is starting and where the reinforcement is appearing, because those will totally influence the behavior that you're getting. So considering the setup so that the dog is consistently rehearsing a movement that is part of the behavior that you want. And then, of course, making sure that you're also clicking that movement, because you get what you click. But it's that whole picture, getting that consistent movement, even if it means a smaller piece than a whole sit, is going to result in a more precise, more accurate, and ultimately more fluent behavior than getting a full sit that is different every time. The dog does it 10 times, he sits a little bit differently every time in that 10, then that's not going to be a strong behavior. We want to get that clean loop, that small slice of behavior that is performed very consistently. Okay, another quality of fluency is that fluent behaviors are faster. And we all want faster behaviors, whatever the sport, except maybe tracking, but still, if you're out in a tracking field at dawn, it's okay if your dog gets it over with, as long as he's, again, also on track. So he's also being accurate and precise. But we want the behaviors generally to be faster. We want a little bit of hustle. And it's easy, I think, to maybe in our heads flip around the dependency there and think of, I have to get the behavior faster so that it can be fluent. Most of the time, though, fluency, that speed is a component of the fluency. So most of what we need for speed comes from the dog being familiar and confident with the behavior. So if we do nothing else but make sure that before we raise criteria, that the dog is truly confident that we're seeing all the external emotional signals that we associate with a relaxed, confident, happy dog. We see no emotional signals of a dog that may be anxious or concerned. And again, that's going to circle back around to that performing without hesitation, right? So as soon as the dog swallows a treat, he immediately performs a consistent movement with his body. That's going to be by nature faster. In general, we are slower when we're learning because we're thinking very hard. As a behavior becomes more familiar, brushing your teeth, driving a stick shift, you can do it faster because your brain becomes more efficient. And again, it's not because anything's acting on the outside. It's not because someone is actively reinforcing or punishing faster, slower responses. It's just because the nature of learning, the nature of the brain, is to become more efficient with behaviors that are performed frequently. That's how we're evolved, right? That's part of that evolutionary aspect, that biological aspect of behavior. So that's most of the job, is making sure that the dog is confident, that we don't raise criteria too quickly. Okay. But we maybe can also manipulate a few other variables if we really want to emphasize speed, if we want to bring up the speed of a behavior, make the behavior faster. One of the things that we can't avoid talking about is arousal. When a dog or a person is aroused, behaviors tend to be faster. The nervous system is more charged, signals travel more quickly, muscles contract faster, the whole behavior actions, the whole system is more sensitive, actions occur more quickly. So if we want to bring a increase the speed of a behavior, bringing in some arousal is a good idea to a point. And the critical aspect, critical component here, the thing I really want you to think about is that to get the ideal conditioned response, we want to bring that arousal in after the behavior. So we want the cue for the behavior, just the word sit, to have a classical association with here comes a tennis ball, assuming that tennis balls are very arousing for your dog, which maybe they are, maybe they're not. But let's pretend it's a golden retriever who gets very aroused when a tennis ball is out. That would be pretty common, right? If I bring the tennis ball out, get the dog wound up, and then cue the sit, I may get a faster sit, but the tennis ball has become part of the cue. It's part of the antecedent. If I really want faster sits, I want to associate the cue sit with the appearance of the tennis ball. And that's a one-way road. So we need to say sit, get any kind of sit, then bang, here comes the tennis ball. And when we make the association that way, that's when we will get faster performances over time. Not just in that single moment, which I can definitely get a faster sit from your average golden if I have a tennis ball in my hand, holding it up by my face while I say sit. But that's not going to give me the faster sit in situations where I don't have the tennis ball. Flip it around the other side is if I pair the word sit, no tennis ball visible, with the dog performing a sit, performing the behavior to, you know, to at least some acceptable degree, and then I bring out this really exciting arousal, high energy reinforcer, then that effect, that emotional response that the dog has to the tennis ball is going to be paired with the behavior and paired with the cue for sit. So again, we're sticking with that A, then B, then C plan, right? And that's kind of the important part. Like, that's a mistake I made really a lot. I continue to kind of make it because it's really reinforcing for me if I'm trying to work on downs and my dog is laying down, but it's maybe just doesn't have the hustle I'm looking for. I pull out his tug toy, I get him really excited, and I cue down. Man, he starts dropping like he's been shot, right? Like, that feels really good for me. I feel very powerful, very in control. In the moment, does me absolutely no good when I cue a drop down the road. So I want to make sure that I have the correct ordering of cue, then high arousal response. And high arousal may also just mean higher value. So you could go from food to a toy if you have, you know, golden retriever or a Malinois or a border collie. But it could, if you have like Larry the Labrador, kibble to steak would have the same effect of bringing that arousal up. Again, the important part is that it comes after the behaviors performed. It's the reinforcer, and that gives us that forward leaking of emotional response that results in that classical conditioning association. The other thing that we can do is adjust the timing of our event marker. If you're using a click or a verbal event marker that says, yes, begin reinforcement, we can encourage faster responses by marking the initiation of that response. So last week, we talked about latency as the time between when the cue is given and when the dog begins to respond. And we talked about a couple of different reasons why that may be slower or it may be faster. And one of the strategies that we can use, or probably the most important strategy that I use with my dogs and that I teach for my students, is that clicking that very initiation, because it's, if you look at the knowing what to do, and that transition moment between knowing what to do and actually doing what you know, the very first moment of that doing what you know is that visible initiation of the response. So the moment the dog begins to respond to the cue, click that, mark that, and then reinforce as quickly as possible. Yes, it's going to mean that the dog bounces out of the sit and may not even completely sit all the way down, and that's okay. This is just one strategy that we're combining with a whole bunch of other things. I wouldn't have you click the initiation of the sit and reinforce, you know, by throwing the ball for exclusively for 6 weeks, because yes, that would teach a dog to rock his weight back and then explode forward. That's not really what we want. We want the dog to begin sitting as quickly as possible. And then in the next session, we may work on duration. In the next session, we may work on distraction proofing. But when we are sharpening up speed as a specifically as a factor of fluency and or latency, because those things tend to come together frequently, we want to mark that very first, the earliest you can train your eye to see, that very first beginning of the movement and reinforce as quickly as possible. So that whole cycle is very, very short. That's going to give us the best effect in speeding up a behavior. And then we also want a fluent behavior is a stronger behavior, right? It's more reliable. That's the word that comes up all the time in pet dog, service dog, obedience. We want reliability. We want a strong behavior. Well, what causes a strong behavior? What we're talking about usually here really is reinforcement history. We need a lot of mass on that behavior. A behavior that has been reinforced 1,000 times is going to be stronger than a behavior that's been reinforced 4 times, right? That's almost always going to be the case, Murphy's Law accepting. If it's a behavior you don't want, it'll only take 1 or 2 repetitions and then you have it forever to live with. But for the most part, the more reinforcement history, the more deposits in that bank account a behavior has, the stronger that behavior is going to be. But we want to go a step further for that reliable behavior. We also want to vary the reinforcement. And this is where my advice may go off a little bit from what maybe you've heard from other places. And I'm pretty sure that I'm right, but that's fine. And where I put my emphasis for, again, for my dogs, for my students, is in varying the type of the reinforcement that the dog receives for the behavior. I'm less interested at this point in my journey in varying the reinforcement at all. So the dog sits. You're maybe familiar with a variable schedule of reinforcement. So maybe I'm only going to reinforce every 3rd or 5th or 7th time that the dog sits on cue. Well, what I don't love about a variable schedule of reinforcement is that it tends to lead to variable behavior, because every repetition of that behavior, a sit, retrieving beer from the fridge, picking up your keys, getting in the kennel, whatever, every time that happens and it isn't reinforced, the dog has at least one repetition of an extinction experience, right? I did the thing, it didn't happen, I didn't get reinforced. There's a little extinction there. Every time we get a little bit of extinction, we get a little bit of frustration, and that tends to cause us to perform a little bit differently the next time. If it happens several times in a row, then our variability of how we perform that behavior tends to vary a lot. So think about, just this past week, I was waiting to cross the street. I had parked downtown. We were going across the street to go to, let's call it a restaurant, and I pushed the button for the crosswalk and nothing happened. So I pushed a little bit harder. I came around at a slightly different angle and pushed slightly differently. And then I saw the light go on, and then it made a little sound and made me know that it had registered the push, the button press. It was that I didn't get reinforced that led me to change the behavior of button pushing. I tried a slightly different way. Well, if that one didn't work, maybe this one will. So if my dog sits perfectly straight, and if you are campaigning for championship points, all you really care about is that your dog sits straight. If my dog sits perfectly straight and I don't reinforce it and he comes in and tries a little bit different, that's going to kind of kill me, right? Like if he comes in perfectly straight, he doesn't get reinforced, that perfect straightness experiences a little tiny drop of extinction. The next sit is going to be different. Maybe it's faster. Maybe it's harder. Maybe he sits, I don't know what the other variable he might experiment with, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's a little bit more crooked. Maybe he bumps me before he sits. Maybe he adds a nose poke. Those are all things that are taking me away from my goal, right? They're taking me down the wrong road. That's not what I want. So I want to make sure that every correct response that my dog performs is reinforced in some way. And there's lots of different ways that I can reinforce. Certainly I can click and treat, right? I do that a lot, especially in the learning stages. But I might also mark and deliver a toy reinforcer. I might also mark and send him to some environmental real life reinforcer. He can go out the door. He can go sniff a bush. He can go pee on something. He's an intact boy. He likes to pee on stuff. It's very high probability behavior for him. I could also give the cue for the next behavior in a sequence or a chain that we're working on. All of those things would function as reinforcers for that behavior. So we're out of extinction territory now. Now we're safe, we're reinforcing, but we're reinforcing in a lot of different ways. And I think this is probably the most important and often overlooked aspect of building those strong behaviors, is varying that type of reinforcement. So we don't have that expectation to disappoint the dog. This also makes sure that our consequence, our reinforcer, isn't accidentally getting wrapped into the cue or the antecedent. We want to make sure that the C stays very separate from the A. A has to come before C. And if I'm giving a cue with a toy in my hand or with my hand approaching my pocket or treat pouch, then that the action that I am about to do to deliver the C is automatically becoming part of the A. And that's a big training problem that I've seen myself, unfortunately, in my own dogs. And I see it a lot in my students when they are, you know, they come in with a troubleshooting problem. There's been some leakage. And one of the ways to ensure that your C doesn't get wrapped into your A is vary the C. If you sometimes have a ball and sometimes you're using food and sometimes you're sending the dog to sniff and sometimes you're going to take off running and play a chasey game, then there's a lot less association of what you, whatever action you do, even if you're not a perfect trainer, which none of us are, it's going to be much less predictive of what behavior, of what type of reinforcement is coming. So as we're building these strong fluent behaviors, again, we can't really cleanly slice this out from stimulus control because we have to really pay close attention to all of those antecedents because they completely affect what the behavior is that we get and when we get it. We want a strong behavior. We want a lot of control over those antecedents. We want to be very clear about what they are. And we want to be able to reinforce that behavior with as many different types of reinforcement as possible. So just to review and wrap up, fluency is what happens when behaviors are so strong that they happen with very little mental effort on the learner's part. They can be done almost without thinking about it. When a behavior is fluent, it's fast, it's consistent, it's both precise and accurate, and it's reliable because it has a very high probability of occurring, which means it's been reinforced a lot, like my refrigerator opening behavior. Reinforced a lot over time, and now even if there's nothing interesting in there, the behavior's not going to go away. I hope that little exploration was helpful for you. If you are a positive reinforcement trainer looking to get started competing in obedience, if you're not, you should be. We need a lot more in obedience with me. I need more friends to come with me. But check out my mentorship program, Zero to CD. And that's where we put together a complete game plan for incorporating all the elements of fluidity, all the elements of fluency, from motivation to confidence building, precise skills, ring preparation, distraction proving. We're going to put it all together into a complete program and give you a plan so that it relieves your cognitive load and you can focus on doing really good dog training and then on later on winning some ribbons and impressing your friends and neighbors. So check it out, www.zerotocd.com. I'd love to see you there. Until next week, happy training.
Thanks for listening. To find the show notes for this episode and to find even more helpful articles and training tips, head over to my website, wonderpupstraining.com. You can even grab a free PDF template to help you plan your training session and stay organized. Until next time, I'm Hannah Branigan. Happy training. Cheers.